You were just mentioning about Dick Guy's son.
Yes, that was the reason he went back. He went back to be dean of the Sydney Medical School. He stopped neurosurgery, and he had a technique of clipping aneurysms which required me to do a sternotomy and clamp the carotid arteries going up to the brain, having cooled the patient. It would take us all day, whereas I'd been used to using hypertension and doing an aneurysm in about 2 hours. Well, but and Dick would operate furiously and then have to go away. And I don't think he actually understood that in those days, neurosurgeons had to know how to treat neurologists.
Yes,
And
indeed they did.
having spent a year at Queen Square with some of the time with McArdle, who's a wonderful neurologist, and various others. If you were asked to see a patient, you were expected to give an opinion, and then the neurologist would decide whether or not he wanted you to operate or not. And I'd been well trained, well brought up to do that, whereas Dick would go along and before Brian Matthews knew where he was, the patient was in the operating theatre, which did not go down very well.
Just to backtrack, you said how Cambridge Anatomy. Was that Geoffrey Harris? Was he there then, or had he come to Oxford?
No, Geoffrey Harris. He wasn't there when I was
No.
there. It was a chap called Boyd who was professor of anatomy.
Related to Richard Boyd?
No, I might have been.
I think he was. I
How
think so.
interesting. I'd never
Yes.
realised that connection.
Yes.
Thinking about it, they look similar.
Right.
But at one time, Pam Harris, who was Geoffrey Harris's daughter, was my secretary. I was a bit busy the first few years.
So who else was a consultant then?
There were
Because you must
just
have
the two
appointed
of us,
others.
Dick Guy and
Yeah,
myself.
but when he went, you must have appointed
Mike
others.
Briggs was appointed,
Yes.
and his interest was head injuries and stereotactic surgery. And to be honest, I was probably quite a difficult colleague. I was quite forceful.
Well, you need to be if you're a surgeon, I
And I used to insist on basically running the department,
think.
and I would do a ward round. I'd see the patients at least every day, and but it meant we were very efficient because if the patient needed to go, they went back to the sending hospital and so on. So with a few beds, we managed to run quite a tight ship.
How many did you have? Roughly 15, say, or
I can't
no?
remember. I think we had enough in one ward.
Yes,
And then
yes.
there was, which was 21 beds, I think.
Right.
And then the head injury lot were downstairs in Cronshaw.
Yes.
But the accident service was really good.
Yes.
And we supplied neurosurgery to it, and we would see the patients. And it was a world winner in a way. And very sadly, when the new hospital was built, that was destroyed.
That was one of the great arguments, wasn't it, about
Well, I was very much involved with that argument because I mean, initially we were destined to go up there, and then Peter Morris came and said he wanted to go up there, so we were left back at the Radcliffe, which basically destroyed the accident service.
Yeah.
And I remember writing several documents and giving them to Doll, Richard Doll, saying the only logical way here was that all the acute work was in one hospital and you could have one ITU, and that should be the new hospital. And then people would have to get used to doing their less acute work on a different site. Not ideal, but it seemed to me logical. The argument against that was that the university had supplied a quarter of the cost of a new John Radcliffe Hospital, therefore they wanted a quarter of a hospital. Of course, they didn't want beds, but they would have the office space. So they had a stranglehold of who went in and who didn't. And basically, it wasn't good for Oxford medicine. That was a...
There was a huge argument and a lot of weeping about it.
There was, yes. I remember David Hodson coming into my office, and he was white with anger because I said what I thought, which didn't agree with what he thought, but in a way...
Oh, gosh. He was an anaesthetist.
He was an anaesthetist, but his role was to sort out who went up to the...
Right.
The new hospital,
yes.
Who didn't.
Because we stayed down, essentially, some outpatients up there, and I was always actually quite glad we had, being, you know, reasonably cold medicine.
Yes.
And it was great, actually, in a way.
It's a great hospital.
Yes.
I really enjoyed the Radcliffe. It was a pity, though, the accident service got destroyed.
Yes, no, indeed. Now, the subarachnoid hemorrhage, am I right, you did some work with John Honor on... clotting or fibrin or...
That's right. It wasn't with John Honor, it was with another chap in the pharmacology department. What's very interesting about subarachnoid hemorrhage is that one of the really bad effects of a subarachnoid hemorrhage is after about 3 or 4 days, the vessels in the head go into spasm. And this is a very specific thing.
Right.
For intracranial vessels, and the patients would just infarct off. And I had one patient who I remember very well who had a subarachnoid hemorrhage, he had an anterior communicating artery aneurysm and terrible spasm on the angiogram, and I waited 6 weeks for that chap's spasm to clear, and then I operated and found that that aneurysm had not ruptured. And the culprit was one in the posterior fossa, vertebral or basilar. And in those days, we didn't do routine vertebral angiography.
Yes.
We couldn't do it easily. So he had terrible spasm. I reoperated. He developed even worse spasm and died.
Because John Honor was fascinated, because one of Pickering's dicta was that you didn't get vascular spasm. I don't know if you knew that. But Pickering was always saying this about...
You don't get it outside the
right.
The head.
Yes.
But it was incredible. You do an angiogram, there'd be no spasm, and then just where the carotid goes through the dura, you get the spasm.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of work on that. We used to do emergency PMs and get the basilar artery, and basilar arteries continued to contract for several days after death, so you can use them as a preparation.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried all kinds of things to counteract spasm.
Mm-hmm.
And we put on CSF from patients and watch the spasm and try and counter it. And in fact, in those days, I used to, during surgery, I used to cannulate the superficial temporal artery to feed a catheter down into the carotid so we could do serial angiograms in just in the ITU, just one picture, just to try and follow how this happened. And then we could inject substances to try and stop it.
Yes.
And we injected everything we could conceive of.
Perforin didn't work.
Nothing worked.
No, sure.
Nothing. Sure. Nothing worked. I mean, there are some very powerful vasodilators, and they didn't touch it.
Who was the pharmacologist?
Well, it David Boulin.
Oh yes, I know. With Graham Smith. With David Graham Smith. Yes.
Yeah, we did this work with David Boulin, who sadly, in a way, lost interest, and we still don't know the cause. Yeah. But there is something that takes about 3 days to develop in this bloodstained CSF,
right.
Some breakdown of the hemoglobin molecule.
Yes.
But it doesn't happen for 3 days and then bang.
What had your essay at Queen Square been on? Was it on subarachnoids?
No, it was on the cervical spine,
right,
which I still think people haven't got right, because the cervical spine is an amazingly mobile structure.
Mm-hmm.
If you x-ray inflection and extension, the range of movement is over 150 degrees or something like that. And what I did was to put x-ray markers on the dura and the cervical cord and the nerve roots, and took x-rays in the basement of a Middlesex hospital with that radiographer. If you mention her name, I'll remember.
No, I won't know.
Well, she was wonderful. I mean, most people thought this was pretty bizarre.
Well, how did you get inside the Middlesex?
Through Valentine Lowe.
Of course, of course. Valentine. Yes.
And I still think the biomechanics of the cervical spine and what happens to the cord and the roots when you move from flexion extension, terribly important in the genesis of cervical myelopathy.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well,
because no movement, no myelopathy.
Right.
But nobody was doing flexion extension views before while they were trying to assess patients.
Right.
Extraordinary. And the other thing, which was very relevant, was that people were doing laminectomies, and there was a group of patients who, after about 18 months, would deteriorate. They would get further myelopathy. And this was always said to me, we've got the diagnosis wrong, it's MS or some other reason. But actually, I am convinced what they did was they did the laminectomy, they opened the dura, exposed the spinal cord, and in those days it was considered a very good idea to cut the dentate ligaments on either side of the spinal cord to sort of free it up. Well, actually, after about a year, you get a scar from the cervical muscles,
mm-hmm.
which would be attached to the spinal cord.
Right.
with the dura left open sometimes, or would have been left open. So when they started regaining movement, they were just tugging on their spinal cord because the dura was fixed at the foramen magnum and fixed where the surgery had taken place. So there was a traction on the spinal cord with flexion. And I'm still think this explains the deterioration. And if that patient has a very mobile neck, then you shouldn't be doing a laminectomy.
No.
And if you do a laminectomy, you certainly should not be opening the dura and cutting the dentate.
No.
So that was really the basis of my thesis. And it's actually been a lifelong interest to me, because nobody has accepted or thought about the importance of the biomechanics.
They began to do x-rays in flexion and extension, though, didn't they?
Well, I did routinely.
Well,
Every patient, because it just seemed illogical.
Yes.
I mean, if you're going to do an anterior fusion, which was often the better option, why not know what the movement is like? And, of course, sometimes there's an actual slippage of one bone on the other, which is a cause of a myelopathy, and you have to do flexion extension views often to see that.
Mm-hmm.
And I resigned from the British Cervical Spine Society because I got so fed up with the, well, just about everyone else, but certainly the orthopods who belonged mm-hmm. to it, they just looked at an X-ray and that was it.
Then lumbar spinal troubles, lumbago, that caused a lot of debate always,
to
operate or not operate.
Yes, I did a lot of lumbar spine surgery and kept saying that you do back operations for leg pain, not back pain.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You cannot cure wear and tear in the back by operating on it. Just very occasionally there's some people with a slip of L4 on L5 or L3 on L4 where you can cure their back pain by fusing. But basically you do back operations for leg pain. And in a way, the development of spondylosis was nature's way of doing a fusion,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which meant you didn't have to put in lots of metal, which of course is the current trend. People can't operate now on the neck or the back without putting in screws and rods and goodness knows what else, which makes it a much bigger operation. I mean, sometimes there was indication for that, but the vast majority of cases not.
Right. And then Peter Teddy got appointed.
Peter got appointed. Again, very difficult to get additional consultants appointed. I think I had to threaten to resign before getting anyone. But Peter got appointed, and his interest was very much in the spine, and he had sessions at Stoke Mandeville and started putting in stimulators in the spinal cord and this sort of thing. And I desperately wanted to get some sort of academic aspect to mm-hmm. neurosurgery because
mm-hmm.
I felt that it was a subject worthy of academic input.
Yeah. Well, you were an investigator, obviously, in what you've been saying.
Yes.
But when you were in that job, you couldn't have had that amount of time.
No, it was a matter of encouraging others.
Yes.
To do that sort of work.
And Cadu Hudson, I suppose, he investigated a bit.
Who?
Cadu Hudson.
Oh, Cadu Hudson. Yes. I mean, we did... I had slightly fraught relationships with the university.
Right.
I think it would be fair to say.
No, it's fine.
Professor Weatherall, bless him, thought that neurosurgery was not an academic subject.
No, it is funny. You didn't think metabolism was.
And I apparently mortally upset him by saying I just did not have time to write a chapter for his book.
Right.
I think he felt it was a massive honour. Well, I'd just done one for Peter Morris's book, and I was busy. And I said I felt I couldn't do a good job doing it. And John Ledingham, who I thought was just wonderful, I just loved John Ledingham, he said, oh, don't worry, he doesn't understand that surgeons have to spend most of their time operating. But Peter Morris, to be honest, I felt Oxford was good for Peter, but I'm not sure Peter was good for Oxford surgery, because he was very much confined to his particular renal transplantation, and there wasn't any encouragement to develop academic people in other specialties.
No, there wasn't, was there? That's right.
And I felt that was a real shame. But eventually I did manage to get Richard Kerr appointed as a reader of neurosurgery, and he was going to do some work on the effect of transplants in the ventricles,
mm-hmm.
In relation particularly to treating Parkinson's disease with implants. And unfortunately, Richard spent all this time doing clinical work, and that upset Peter, understandably.
Mm-hmm.
But that really put the kibosh on further development of academic neurosurgery till Thibaut Aziz arrived, who was and is an absolute jewel in the neurosurgical arena, I think. Incredible man.
And then you must have been very gratified at the pituitary results with Chris Burke.
Yeah, I was very lucky that two big areas of my work was the pituitary side and the epilepsy side.
Mm-hmm.
And I had John Oxbury, who assessed the epilepsy patients, and Chris Burke, who assessed the pituitary. And actually, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that surgeons should not assess their own results.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think lots of studies have shown this. But so I had John Oxbury, who was very good at assessing patients who would be candidates for epilepsy surgery, and Chris Burke, who was obviously very good. It was quite difficult as a surgeon to get used to being criticised, I suppose, by his physicianly colleagues, but it was the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris Burke was very rigorous in his assessment.
Yes.
And it was right, it was good. Mm-hmm. And then John Woss took it on. But the history of epilepsy surgery is quite interesting because I had seen quite a lot of epilepsy surgery with Murray Faulkner,
mm-hmm.
and the guy's Morsi unit. And Kit Anstead was here when I came.
Mm-hmm. In Wolvercote?
The park. Yes, he lived in Wolvercote, and he ran the park hospital.
Yes.
And Kit always had a cigarette in his mouth, of course. But he was a wonderful man. And
yes,
he really treated the children as a whole person and was very shrewd. And I remember one patient that, it must have been very soon after I'd arrived here, Murray Faulkner had been asked to see this boy who lived in Manchester, mm-hmm. and was destroying the family. He developed fits around 10 or 12, beating up his sister, knocking doors down. Murray saw him and turned him down for surgery because he had bitemporal independent spikes.
Right.
And said, you can't operate. And Kit asked me, he came to see Kit Anstead, and Kit asked me to see him. And I had a look at him and saw the x-ray, and I could see a very tiny speck of calcium in the right temporal lobe, which I don't think Murray could have seen. But I said to Kit, well, there's the pathology. And I was convinced that epilepsy surgery should be like any other form of surgery. You find the pathology and remove it. At Montreal, which was the font of epilepsy surgery, they indulged in what I called spike chasing. They would do these massive operations on the local with young kids and do EEGs on the brain, electrocorticography, and find the spikes and suck away the brain until the spikes went. Of course, a lot of pathology went down the sucker. So anyway, I said to Kit, I thought we ought to do a temporal lobectomy on this boy. And he agreed. So I did a right temporal lobectomy. I found a little calcified sort of astrocytoma or hamartoma, took it out, and that boy never had another fit.
Mm.
And the interesting thing to me was that the spikes on the other side, the left temporal lobe, completely disappeared.
Yes. Yeah.
So I was absolutely convinced that you had to find pathology and remove it. Rather, don't worry about the spikes. But in those days, you know, kids were going to Great Ormond Street and they would refuse to recommend people for surgery. And I would often get them via Kit Anstead.
Right.
And we would operate on them. But that was the official line. Epilepsy surgery was a no-go area. And the two paediatric neurologists at Great Ormond Street would not recommend patients for it. But it's all changed now.
Yes.
But I made myself very unpopular going to some meeting in Palm Springs saying that it was a matter of finding pathology and forget about the spikes. And of course all the electroencephalographers were furious, but I think subsequent events have shown that that's right.
So how much did you use L. Poole in the electro?
Very little.
I mean, about other colleagues, say compared to London, what did you think of the nursing at the Radcliffe?
Fantastic.
Good.
Really good. And the nice thing was we were a family. We were a team. Neurosurgery on Nuffield 1, we all worked together. We never, hardly ever cancelled a patient.
No.
And if we ever had to, the ward sister and I, we would really sort of meet together and really think about it. And
yes.
It was so rare. And there was a fantastic sort of family feel.
Okay. And then the pathologists?
Well, there was, of course, Trevor Hughes and David Oppenheimer. And they were very nice. We had pathology sessions with them. David Oppenheimer was a delight, but he was much more academic, I think. And my memory of David would be if we sent off a biopsy during surgery, he would poke his head round the operating room door and he would always say, "Could it be a meningioma?" He was so anxious not to miss a meningioma, which of course was curable, and the glioma was not, basically. But some gliomas aren't curable. It's just luck of the draw. I mean, some gliomas, most of course aren't, but one of the very last patients I operated on was a young girl of 23 who had a glioma, I took out, and I sent her off for radiotherapy, and I said, "Ignore the radiotherapists, they'll say you have 6 months to live," which in fact it did say. And I said, "I'm pretty confident I've taken this out." And actually she was a lawyer and she went back to work. She subsequently got married to a Frenchman and has had 3 children, and I still hear from her from time to time.
Lovely. That is interesting, because it's against the orthodoxy.
Absolutely.
Yes. No, and great.
That's why I used to say statistics are meaningless for the individual.
Sure. So, I mean, you said how you enjoyed sculling and felt so good. Did you feel like that after a big operation?
I felt drained.
Yeah.
I mean, acoustic neuromas, I always felt, used to age me.
Right. Because, they're very difficult, are they?
Well, the patient is always worse,
right,
because they may not have completely lost their hearing. They usually didn't have a facial weakness, and you were incredibly pleased if you could take out what in those days were fairly big acoustics and still preserve the facial nerve, which was stretched over the tumour.
Yes.
And they were long, stressful operations. In general, I loved operating. I found it relaxing. And I found operating not difficult. And I was away from the telephone, away from outpatients, and I was just there. And I think it's a bit like being an athlete. You get in a zone.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're just totally concentrating down a microscope on one minute area, and nothing else impinges on you.
So, I mean, in your latter time, what percentage of operations would have the dissecting microscope?
The operating microscope? Majority.
You are, yeah, sort of 90%.
In the head.
Yes.
Not in the... not so much, well, occasionally in the spine if you were doing removing a tumour from the spinal cord, but that was pretty rare. I suppose my other area of interest, which quite an amusing story really, I got very interested in trigeminal neuralgia. And the theory developed that this was all due to compression of the fifth nerve at where it enters the brain stem by an artery or a vein. And the more I thought about that theory, the more it didn't add up, because one of the things about trigeminal neuralgia is that it's episodic. People can go for months without it. I wrote an article which I sent to the American Journal of Neurosurgery, which they rejected, and the reason was that it wasn't everybody in America believed the cross compression of the fifth nerve. And I produced a lot of reasons why this couldn't be, and they were very unhappy about accepting it. And I learned a lot from this, that so-called science is full of emotion.
I know, right?
Very, very little I decided to do with facts. And eventually they published it, and there was a huge outcry saying how unfair I'd been to Janetta, this American neurosurgeon whose theory I'd criticised. And I pointed out some interesting facts, like black Africans never get trigeminal neuralgia, but they get hypertension early, and that's therefore their vessels become tortuous, and you'd expect it more often in people with dementia because of the atrophy in the upper brain, and so on and so forth. But about 3 months ago, I got an email from an American neurosurgeon who's always taken an interest in trigeminal neuralgia. He said, I've been thinking about trigeminal neuralgia for the last 40 years, and I think your paper is right.
Well, what did that mean for therapy? Because they used to inject the ganglion.
Well, I think it doesn't... If you want to stop trigeminal neuralgia, you just have to damage the nerve a bit.
Yes.
And Walter Dandy used to rub it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, expose the nerve and with a blunt hook just rub it. And his results were just as good as the microvascular decompression. You can use the gamma knife, which is quite a good way of insulting it. And the less you insult it, the more preservation of sensation you'll get, but the higher recurrence rate. So it's a sort of swings and roundabouts.
Does anybody know the pathogenesis?
No. We don't. And I'm sure there must be a genetic factor. I'm sure they'll find there's a biochemical factor. I mean, it does occur to people with MS, of course. That's not uncommon. And it may well be that some sort of mechanical disturbance of the nerve root is a factor, but it isn't in the majority. I think the important thing is to keep an open mind. I was asked to go to the World Congress of Neurosurgery and to give a paper on trigeminal neuralgia, and Janetto, who was this American neurosurgeon, was asked to give the paper, so we were encouraging a debate. So he gave his paper. And then I got up to give mine, and Janetta and a Japanese neurosurgeon called Fukushima stood at the back and barracked while I gave my paper, which was sort of slightly unusual, I felt. And at the end, Fukushima came up and He bowed very low and he said, "Mr. Adams, I'm very sorry. That was a very un-Japanese thing to do." And we became very good friends after that.
Yes.
But you see, Tegretol is a great treatment, but you know, how does that suddenly work if it's all a mechanical compression?
Yes. So how many articles did you write for Medical Scientific Journals?
Oh, quite a lot in a way.
40, I mean, 80?
I like to think that the sort of contributions I made were cervical spine, which I have to say I don't think my contributions have yet been appreciated, but that's all right. Trigeminal neuralgia I wrote a lot about, and obviously epilepsy surgery and pituitary surgery. I mean, I got one interesting story. I was asked to give a lecture in the Ether Dome at Mass General, on cervical myelopathy. So I went along and I showed my research on movement and how that affects the dura and so on and so forth, and explained that I like to analyse the biomechanics of the cervical spine and then decide what sort of surgery should be done, either decompression or effusion from in front or so on. So I gave my talk, and the neurosurgeons there were pretty scathing, you could say. And they said, "Oh, we get very good results just doing a decompressive laminectomy. We don't need to do fusions from in front. We don't need to analyse all this nonsense." So I said, "Okay, well, there we are." And at the end of a lecture, Professor Raymond Adams came round. He's Professor of Neurology at Mass General. He said, "Mr. Adams, that was a very interesting talk. Thank you." He said, "You know, the results for surgery for cervical spondylotic myelopathy here are so bad, I've stopped referring patients to the surgeons." And obviously, you know, the surgeons were operating on a small group of people with very narrow and immobile cervical spines. Mm-hmm. There is a group where they're born narrow and they get narrower, and they can't move their spines. Well, those are absolutely ideal patients for doing a decompressive laminectomy, because you open up the canal and they're not moving much, so that they can't cause a traction injury of a scar. But all the others, they weren't getting. So it's just an interesting illustration of how selection influences surgical results, and how you've got to be so careful about making sort of sweeping statements.
Then, obviously, say subarachnoid hemorrhage, but other things too, depend on the emergency medical people to an extent.
Well, now,
how satisfactory did you find that in the old days?
I think people came pretty well trained in any sudden unusual headache coming on like that.
Yeah.
Which lasts for more than 24 hours, is a subarachnoid hemorrhage tool proved otherwise. Yes. One of the problems was getting people to do lumbar punches.
Right.
Because in the old days, of course, everyone did lumbar punches, but then the CT scan came along, and people thought, well, we can get out of doing a lumbar puncture. We'll do a scan, which, of course, they had to wait till the next morning, and this sort of thing used to drive me nuts, because as I kept quoting Honor Smith. Do you remember Honor?
Oh, I do indeed. But, well,
she said you need 24 hours of life left to cure meningitis.
Right. Yeah.
And which is true.
Yes.
And if you've got a fulminating pneumococcal meningitis, which can come on very quickly, you know, they're dead in 24 hours. So you've got to do that lumbar puncture there and then. And I stood over SHOs saying, "I will take full responsibility for this lumbar puncture, but you've got to do it." And as Trevor Hughes rightly used to say, more people die of late diagnosed meningitis than people die from coning.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
But people became frightened of doing lumbar punches because of the fear of coning.
Yes. Then after Philip Sheldon, would it have been Andy Molyneux?
Yeah, Andy was great.
Yes.
I think I was on the appointment committee for Andy, and there were several candidates, but actually what happened was that they appointed somebody who wasn't Andy, and I remember saying, I think we should have a spare in case this chap doesn't take the job. And they agreed on Andy Molyneux.
Being the backup or he offering was the backup. Him a job, yes.
He was the backup. Yeah. And the chap they offered the job to, in fact, decided not to take it and went to Manchester. And I felt that getting Andy appointed was the best thing I ever did for the Radcliffe Infirmary.
Great.
He was fantastic.
Then he got around to these wires.
Yes, just incredible. I mean, the Russians started this by learning how to detach balloons and putting them in aneurysms, but it was really the French who perfected the technique of putting these wires. These very fine catheters, just to watch them flow directed into the aneurysm and then injecting super glue, or later it became weaving a basket inside. Oh, so skillful. And of course, I thought this, if I had an aneurysm, I'd want Andy Molyneux to do his basketry inside it, because of course you didn't have the problems of spasm.
No.
I was very keen, in fact I encouraged Andy to do this big trial, and because I was about to retire I got Richard Kerr involved with that, but that was a real contribution, I think, to the management of subarachnoid hemorrhage, doing a controlled trial between surgery and
Yes, well, that's essential, really.
Yeah.
Great.
The Americans did not like it.
No, they don't.
Well, the trouble is there, you have one operation surgeons, so that they'd spent their lives learning how to clip aneurysms, and any other technique was a real threat.
And they're driven to an extent by private medicine.
Oh,
I mean, how much private medicine surgery were you doing?
Well, I did quite a lot. We got a lot of overseas patients.
Yes.
And we were making about £1 million a year for the hospital.
Gosh.
And I wrote I don't know if you remember the days of a 3% efficiency.
No, I don't.
Well, in the early 80s, 90s, we had to do 3%, we had to do our work with 3% less for money.
Right, okay.
And of course, the people that were affected were the most efficient. If you had fat to spare, 3% was nothing. If you ran a tight ship, which I like to think we did, 3% was very difficult, and the only way you could accommodate this was to reduce your length of stay each year. And our length of stay, which was already much less than the national average, got faster and faster and faster. We got to the stage of taking out a clot of a patient in Northampton and putting him back in the waiting ambulance to take him back to Northampton.
This is subdural.
No, it was intracerebral.
Right, okay.
I said this was not safe.
No.
And I wrote to David Wilson and said, we are now hyper-efficient, which is not safe.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do about it? So I got no reply. Just standard medical administrator. We try and avoid trouble and bury our head under the sand. And so I wrote a paper called the Oxdon Syndrome, the Inevitable Disease of a National Health Service Reform. Mm-hmm. And I sent this to the BMJ, And basically, I drew pictures of how this sort of wheel of went faster and faster, meaning the length of stay got shorter and shorter. Yes. If you added in the 3% efficiency each year. And I pointed out that there was no way of making this wheel go slower in the NHS.
Yes.
The BMJ liked the article very much. They said it's just the right mixture of passion and fact. And before they published it, they sent it to the Department of Health. So it was like, you know, a wolf going into a chicken run.
Yeah.
Lots of flapping of wings and squawking. And first of all, the chairman of a region came down and said, Mr. Adams, this is not, you know, you mustn't do this, you mustn't publish it, and it wouldn't be good for your career.
Oh, God, that is so terrible.
Well,
to say that.
This is the truth.
Well, I'm sure it's true.
And
I'm sure it is.
I chose to take no notice. You know, I was fortunately fairly well on in my career, and that sort of thing didn't bother me.
No.
And then the regional medical officer came and sat in my kitchen, Barbara Stocking.
Right.
And she said, oh, Mr. Adams, this article of yours, it's not right, surely. We cost every patient in the NHS individually. And I sort of looked at her, gobsmacked,
yes,
and said, there's not one patient in the NHS that's individually costed.
Right.
You don't even know the cost of a private patient, how much to charge them even. It's all X amount of money divided by Y patients.
Yeah.
So there was the regional medical officer, full of the buzzwords, management buzzwords, had absolutely no idea how costing happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty shattered by that. She then went on to be head of Oxfam and is now head of Cambridge College.
That's right.
But I just felt these NHS administrators just didn't understand what it was all about.
No, they don't.
And I used to go around making myself, no doubt, extremely unpopular by saying, no one says, when I'm young, I wanted to be an NHS administrator. They've all tried something else and failed, and therefore...
I know a girl who did, and she left after 6 months.
Well, there you are. Yes. Yeah. So they're all failures. I mean, this may have changed now, but I gather they're getting more medics in to administer, which is, I think, sensible. But my other aphorism, which I'm afraid probably didn't make me many friends, was I used to ask academics, well, what have you done with your research which has changed clinical practice?
Yes, I know, sure.
And they didn't like that at all, but actually I don't think it's an unfair question.
No, I quite agree.
Actually, if you're doing research, you know, we all know a lot of, well, on the surgical side, they all had suntans and they carried their golf clubs and they were away for 6 months in the year.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, if you're being paid to do research, I think you're entitled to ask, well, not how many papers have you written, but actually, what have you done to change how we do things?
Well, no, absolutely. Joe Pennybacker, whenever he saw me in the corridor, would say, what have you discovered this week?
Yes.
And I found that there was a GP out of Burford who apparently, when Joe was young, would be coming in to see his patients, because they did in those days. And he would say to Joe, what have you discovered this week? So that's where that had come from.
Yeah.
And then, were there any other consultants? I mean, there were Mike Briggs, Peter Teddy, Kerr.
Well, then there was Tipu Aziz.
Oh, yes.
Who I think is fantastic. Mm. Tom Cato, there's Cato. So many now.
Yes,
you know, it's all they grown
proliferate, don't they?
And I don't know most of them now.
Tell me about the anaesthetists then.
Did
you have one, as it were?
I had two.
Yes,
I had John Edmund Seal,
mm-hmm,
and John Kerr. They're both very different. John, I always found very, very good, straight up and down. He used to get a bit sort of ratty on occasions, but really,
yeah,
so
gosh,
I really was full of admiration the way John coped with that,
yes,
and his work. But he got obsessed by railways and trains and retired to run one of those little railways in Wales.
Which was
rather,
yes,
nice. And yeah, I tried to introduce a three-session operating day.
Right.
I said, we've got these operating theatres, and we use them from sort of 8 till 6. But that's actually not a good use of a bit of capital.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we should have, instead of two morning and afternoon, we should have an evening session.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he was furious. He said, I've never been so badly treated as blah, blah, blah. It's only something to discuss, but it just seemed to me to make sense.
Well, absolutely. But the anaesthetists, I mean, they limited surgery up at the John Radcliffe, the general surgery. I mean, in my time, because they wouldn't work after 5 o'clock.
No,
well,
it
was
just kind of another session. I mean, it wasn't.
Yeah. No. And you'd have had more anaesthetists. I mean,
yes,
that makes sense.
Exactly. Well,
but I always thought on the staff council, if you get the anaesthetists with you, you'd won, because there are always hundreds of them.
The best chairman of a medical staff council, I thought, was Roger. He was an anaesthetist. Oh, he was so good. I can't remember his name.
An anaesthetist, gosh.
But he would take time to go around and talk to people before
right.
the meetings.
Right, that's good.
It was all sorted.
Yes.
And he was fantastic. The other... I was Secretary of Medical Staff Council when I first arrived. And
as a consultant? A
yes.
Consultant, yes.
Alan Sharp was the
yes.
chairman. He was a lovely lad.
He was.
I really was very fond of Alan.
Yes.
Very sad when he died.
But Roger must have been quite late, is that right?
Yes, I wish I could remember his name.
No, don't worry, because I mean, I think he's after my time. Right?
Yes, I think he was. It took a lot of time, and I suspect only anaesthetists had the time
yes,
to actually
right.
go around and talk to people,
yes.
but he was very good.
Yes. Chris, is there something I should have asked you about?
Not that I can think of. I mean, I've probably been far too outspoken.
No, it's very, very interesting, and nothing rude at all. Perfectly
well,
proper. Because I think people should say what they think, you know, how it came about.
Yeah, I mean, I think I had the best time in the NHS,
yes,
to be honest.
No, no, sure.
And when I qualified, I had the choice of medical defence subscription of £5 a year or £50 for life.
Right.
And I took the £50 for life.
Where did you find the £50?
Well, it was my first paycheck when I was a house officer at Guy's.
Right.
I think we stayed in for 6 months, but that was my first pay packet. Now, a neurosurgeon has to find about £100,000 a year before he can. Yeah.
How did? Because you worked with Joe Pennebaker just as an SHO, is
yes,
that right? Yeah. How did he compare with the people in London?
I worked with Murray Faulkner,
mm-hmm,
who had been at Oxford and thought the world of Oxford. Murray was still using black silk, which everyone else had given up because it was a pain. It became infected and you had to take it all out,
mm-hmm,
and so on and so forth. And I pointed out to Murray once that they'd given up black silk in Oxford, and it was only when he heard that that he would give up black silk.
Right.
But Murray had this rather sort of disturbing laugh, which was humorless, really.
Yeah.
But it was when he was in trouble, and he was a television programme. They filmed Murray doing an acoustic, and I still cringe at this because there's this awful sort of cackle going on while he was doing it, and it wasn't a great operation. But then I worked for Valentine Logue, who was I had great admiration for Valentine. He was quiet, he was obsessional, very good neurologist, very nice man. He, of course, was the son of
the King's Speech.
Yes.
Yeah. He was the little boy reading the book, wasn't he?
He was the little boy reading the book and also making model aeroplanes, which I used to do.
Yes, yes.
Avidly as a boy.
Yeah.
I liked... I suppose the only thing I'd say about Valentine was he really spent a lot of time sort of stopping every capillary bleeding,
right,
which
mm-hmm
was not really necessary. But he would go home and then phone up at 8 o'clock every evening to ask after his patients. You know, he was really very caring. I don't think he actually received the credit that was due to him.
Right.
The other surgeon at Queen Square at the time was Wiley McKissick, who was much more forceful personality,
right,
and tended to get the sort of limelight.
And was there another at the Middlesex with Valentine Logue? Because Diana Beck stopped.
Right. Diana got myasthenia gravis, didn't she?
No,
yeah,
I didn't know
did
that, yes.
And then I think Lindsay Simon took over.
Right.
Okay. Who was at Queen's Square as a sort of lecturer when I was there. Valentine was a very gentle surgeon. I think he was more gentle than Joe. I remember being struck that Joe, I thought, was rather rough.
Right.
Everybody said he was a fantastic surgeon. I think he was, and he probably knew how rough he could be to get away with
it. That speeds it up a bit, presumably.
And he was fast, whereas John Potter was just rough, and when his patients ran out, it was a disaster. And I think, you know, John should never have gone in for neurosurgery. He was interested in head injuries, but of course that wasn't really, that was bone surgery rather than.
And I mean, his helmet work was the good thing he did.
Yes.
Really.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to close down then, Chris, if that's all right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. That was really interesting. Thanks a lot.